Accession number 28674, Mr. Richard Corsbrook, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about when you'd moved up to Mosul. We've established the date was January 43.
Yeah.
To lay a line alongside the railway. And you hadn't discussed that much, but where do you want to go from here?
Right, we went up. We had established our own little camp in Mosul. I can remember that time. It was... We had an office in inverted commas, and I remember it was all...
What was that based in? Tell us about the office. What was it?
Well, it was just an open tent. It was all under canvas. We were under canvas. The boys were under... The troops were under canvas. I was, I think, living with the troops. I don't think I was... There was no established mess anywhere around, so we effectively mucked in. Yes, I was with the British. It was a British line section. It had been all... I mean, it had. It's obvious because that's what we come out from the UK with. And my Batman did all the looking after. Batman's name was Burton, by the way. As far as I remember, he was a flash Harry Londoner.
That's it. How did you get on with Burton? What exactly did he do for you? You know, what was his role?
Everything. I mean, what do I do? He made my bed. He prepared my bed. He took my washing away, and somehow it came back washed. I don't think he did it. I mean, he would have arranged for it to be done by a local system. I can't remember clearly, but he must have produced the food from the kitchen. He was a personal servant. It's something that is now foreign, I suspect, to anybody in the army other than a major general. But you had your Batman servant, Batman driver, and he looked after you. And if he was a good one, you were well looked after. And this fellow I don't know where the hell I got him from, but I brought him in England and taken him out. And, okay, he probably fleeced you like all these sort of people. He'd have probably taken you for a ride financially sometimes, but it didn't really matter. He was the housemaid, either. And he often was the link between you and the lads. I mean, you had the work link, which was through the sergeant and the corporals down to what the job was and what the technicalities of the job. But the sort of personal living, he was there. And I think he was also the driver. I can't remember not having him as the driver as well. It was the usual thing, Batman driver. And the officer would have, in a section, his own 800 weight. What are we? We're all wireless trucks, but if you didn't have a wireless on, necessarily on board, they were all 800. And ours was a Ford V8, which was forever wearing out its front springs. And we used to take it. And this is while we were at Mosul. And it's a pity we haven't a picture of it. We used to take it across to a Polish camp about 20 miles away and go and have a cup of tea with these Poles. I think it was the point to which we were laying this line, actually. And they would take the front spring off, retemper it, and put it back all in an afternoon. And there is an interesting point coming up here because the Poles are beginning to be significant in that part of the world because of the problems of, obviously, they come through Russia. I don't think I've ever laid a line which has ever got anywhere, because by the time line was finished, I had left and gone somewhere else. One other thing we did while we were in Mosul, I was told to go on a line recce across in the direction of Syria. Now, if you get your map out, you'll see where Mosul is, and Syria is more or less west, but not that far. Don't know the tactical reason for it, but we were asked to go on a recce. Could we put a line across to a place called Ballad Singer, B-A-L-A-D-S-I-N-G-A-R. And again, you can find it on the maps. In just inside Syria, I think it was just inside or just outside Syria. I think it came up it's been in the news not so long ago during the Iraq campaign.
Now, what were you looking for when you did a line reconnaissance?
Well, where are you going to put a line? Well, we can't go that way. There's a bloody great ravine that way, so we'll have to take it down that valley or straight over the top. But it was just a question of a bit what Stevenson and Brunel would have. Well, Brunel had it easy, but Stevenson would have done with his railways. Well, we can't go that way. We've got to cross a river. So what are we going to do? Go that way. It was really a question of plotting the right route. I was reminded by looking through my photographs, because we took this recce, or I went on this recce, and this was the first time I find I'd really started using a camera. We had on the recce a bloke called Major Glennie, who was from one of the signal regiments around. And a chap who came, I don't know where he came from, he must have come from headquarters in Baghdad or somewhere, called Armour, who was a pre-war novelist. Now, the trouble is that he claimed to be that, and I've never been able to find any reference to him. We drove across, it was a day's trip back, and we stayed the night in Ballad Singer. We got the police station to put us up. So, as I said before, we all travel with our camp beds and bedrolls, so we can generally make ourselves comfortable wherever we are. Probably our Batman as well. And I remember that we stayed in this police station in Ballad Singer, and they cooked a most god-awful chicken. I mean, it's these things you remember. A chicken pilau. They got a chicken and rice. The poor chicken, it must have given itself up. It was as stringy as hell. And also, there again, I was amazed because, again, in the photographs, there's a picture of the town telephone wiring in Ballad Singer, something that even the most primitive Royal Signals person would never have lived with. Anyway, that's an incident that happened. Interesting, because it was going into a completely uncharted territory that we'd had not had any effect. The army had not been there. It hadn't been there, and there was no effect of the British troops or any other troops there. Well, the next thing is that the next event is being told to go down to having been appointed as G3 lines to the staff of CSO bases and LFC in Basra.
Now, what do all those three things stand for? CSO stands for?
Chief Signal Officer.
So you're in his department?
In his department. Every staff headquarters, major headquarters, will have a Chief Signal Officer. He will be responsible for all Royal Signals activity within the formation, be it a corps. I don't think the corps has a CSO, but a division will.
Now, so you're at base and LFC is?
Bases and LFC.
LFC is?
L, Line of Communication.
LOC, I misheard, it's all right.
LOC. Now, just remember what had happened in the last 12 months. I mean, we are now at the beginning of 43.
So this would be February, would it be? February 43?
February. Yeah, I cannot remember. I had no way of knowing the exact date. I needed a reference to a letter that I would have given it me, but it must have been February, because a lot happened in Basra during that year, and I couldn't have got it all in if I hadn't been if it hadn't been fairly early in the year.
Now, so you were saying you had to remember one thing about this, and then I interrupted you. Sorry about that. So, what was the background to you being appointed to this position?
Well, I could say I don't know, because one never knows what's going on. But remember, I'd done the advanced line course, and presumably had done it with some, without any lack of distinction. I think that's the way around I want to put it. So I was, you know, you probably don't, but tabbed against my name somewhere is more than usually trained in line communication. The lines officer at the CSO bases there, see, I don't know who he was and where he went. Well, I don't remember who he was, and I certainly don't know where he went. And the personnel department, or human resources as it would now be, looked it up and said, oh, there's a bloke, send him. And he got sent. This was the best thing in the world for me, because it took me out of the army and pretty effectively put me into a civil service job. I mean, I never lost another night's sleep from then on through the whole war.
Now, what was the setup at the signals department?
Right. We were in Basra, we were in Margil, and Margil has appeared occasionally.
Now, Margil's part of Basra?
M-A-Q-I-L, an outskirts of Basra. It's down by the river in Basra, or the Shatt al-Arab, or the... It's the port area, or it was in those days. Difficult on a map to find it now, but somewhere between Basra and this Umm Qasr, which is the big port now. I won't say mud huts, but not mud huts. They were the sort of single story hutted accommodation, semi permanent until the rains washed it away. All nicely fitted, single officers' quarters, single rooms, showers out the back, mess across the road, same sort of buildings for the headquarters, the offices. And their offices had obviously been put up in the previous 12 months or so, because don't forget we hadn't been there before 41. We just worked effectively office hours. We went into the office at half past 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and we stopped for lunch.
What were you doing? What was your daily routine of duties?
Well, can't describe it as such. It was the administration. I'm to some extent bullshitting here, but it was the administration of the lines, telephone lines, for the area, which was from Baghdad to Basra, and beginning to be from Basra up through Persia to Tehran. So we had I had to oversee the operation of these telephone lines. To some extent, it was a humdrum job, like you'd get letter coming in from a branch of the headquarters. So I use the word headquarters in that there were a lot of base units around, supply units, service units. Practically nobody, no fighting, no real concentration of fighting troops. There was the RAF out at Shiba, S-U-S-H-U-A-I-B-A, still there, still note, still being used as an RAF base. Well, used again as an RAF base. And the whole lot was connected up by telephone of one sort, one line or another, and Muggins was responsible for...
Now, what did that responsibility mean? I mean, you're responsible for something, but what does it
well,
mean?
Well, okay, the responsibility was this, that one had to, on behalf of the chief signal officer, the colonel who was chief signal officer, one had to ensure that the lines were maintained and that users of the service had the service they expected. In other words, they could have telephones connected and disconnected as they wanted. You know, the lad, effectively, in the, you know, the chap in the post office who does all... I had to make sure that you kept tabs on the fault rates. If a line was falling down regularly, why was it? Get somebody to go and look at it, or get somebody to go and look at it and do something about it. It was an excuse for one hell of a lot of jolly... not me making any bones about it. It was a job which one was on your own devices to a very large extent, going round the area, looking at the... counting the telephone poles, effectively.
Were there any prevailing causes of faults or troubles in the system?
Not that I remember. The biggest problem probably ever across there were the locals pinching the copper. And this varied from area to area. And there's a story coming up when we get to Tehran later on.
Let's save it till then.
Tell you what we did. I remember we liaised with the Navy. There was a wonderful gentleman in the down the road from us. We called him Snopji, and his initials were S-N-O-P-G, and he was the senior naval officer, Persian Gulf. But they were a good lot to keep in touch with, because they were very good at providing bits of radio equipment that I wanted or we wanted to go down there on the scrounge. And it was down while I was down while I wasn't when I came to Basra. The CSO then was one Colonel Martin, and I remember Colonel Martin. I was in one of the workshops, the signals workshops one day, and I said, "Well, what's that radio up there?" And I said, "Oh, Colonel Martin brought that in years ago, or months ago. Don't know what it does, don't know whether it works or not." So I went back to the Colonel. I said, "Hey, do you want that radio?" "No, oh, you can have them both." And I took them away, and it's in the loft now. Yes, you know, I got it working, which wasn't very difficult. And it was my radio for the whole of the war.
And what would you listen to?
BBC, what you would then call, I don't know what it was called. It was always there, it was always on the same frequency, you know, or one of two frequencies. It would be the what we would now call the World Service. I mean, effective.
What did they have on there? What were the broadcasts like? What sort of thing were they broadcasting?
Everything. Everything. Is a silly word, isn't it? Obviously news. The news bulletins were completely straightforward in those days. You wouldn't get a lot of glamorised news like you do on even on the radio. It would be a straightforward news report. John Snagg's voice would come across. There would be variety programmes. Itmar was on then. And... like music. It was very, you know, it was what almost Radio 2, I suppose, these days, nearest equivalent. But, of course, the main thing, as far as we were concerned, was news. There were request programmes from home, you know, your family would write in and get on the get on the radio, and the programs were beamed to, well, I use the word beamed, they were put on transmitters which were appropriate to various parts of the world at various times of the day. And it was completely, it was reliable and consistent. I mean, hardly, it was, I can't remember the frequencies, but it would have been sort of 9 megahertz during the day and going down to 7 at night and up to about 10 to 12 sort of in full daylight, a completely daylight path. And that was the state, that was, we listened right through the war. Again, where was I when VE Day came? Well, I'll tell you when we get there.
Yeah, of course. What happens next? I mean, you've got into, how do you settle in with the staff? I mean, who else is there?
Right, the staff was, now I'm beginning, memory's not all that brilliant. Colonel Martin was CSO. He had, the structure of the staff was this. There'd be a chief signal officer, brigadier. Full colonel. He would have a G2. That was a major. GSO2, general staff officer, grade 2, a major. Now, he was effectively the colonel's dog body. He had to know, he knew about everything, but effectively apportioned the work. I mean, it's very difficult looking back, thinking of how things are organised in businesses now and trying to make it applicable to the relatively relaxed way that everybody knew what their job was and what they had to do and effectively knew their place and just got on with it. And he was the chief assistant to the CSO. He would be presumed to be familiar with all aspects of the job, which was the supervision of the communication, the communication provided by Royal Signals in the whole of the area. Then there would be a lines officer, a wireless officer. That's me, a wireless officer, who I can't remember who it was at that point. But we eventually got a Scottish international rugby player, but I can't remember when we got him, so I'll bring that in later. And there must have been there was always a lieutenant around, a bit of a dog's body. There must have been another captain type, but I can't remember what he did. When we get again to Tehran, maybe I'll look at the pictures and remind myself of who the people were. But that was a structure. And the wireless officer would be responsible for supervising and ensuring that the wireless links that the area needed. I mean, we had a link down to Bahrain and a link to Baghdad and a link to somewhere else. I think we had a link to Isfahan of all places. Of course, the lines job was an absolute doddle, because with lines that when we got there ran to Baghdad and ran out to in the direction of Ahwaz in Persia. I mean, one had to go out and look at these lines. Did not one? And you've already commented on the pictures of the Arch of Ctesiphon. Well, they were taken, and I went up with Mike Butler, who's on that picture. He was the G2 at that time. It was later on in 43, this was. We had gone up following the Kut. Now, which river's that on? That's on the
Tigris.
On the Tigris. We'd gone up the Tigris. And we'd gone via Kut. I mean, why did we go via Kut? Because if you're First World War, you'll know your Kut and Al Amara. And we stopped there and the line post. And silly how one of these things stick in your mind. Outside the the line post, a hut in which the linemen sat, and there might be some terminal equipment. There probably was some equipment because the line came in and went out again. Outside was one of these enormous earthenware chatties, C-H-A-T-T-I, earthenware water container on a stand. I said, well, what's this? He said, well, what we do, this is the corporal, what we do, we go out, when we run out of water, we go out to the middle of the Tigris with a bucket and take some water out from the bottom of the Tigris and pull it up and put it in our chatty. It sits in there and it filters through, and what comes out at the bottom is pure water. And they were still alive, so it must have been all right. And that was their fresh water supply. I mean, that's a silly thing you remember. And that was Kut.
Now, what happened? You went on up to
We drove up. I can't, unfortunately, remember any of the details, except as it's obvious on this particular outing. I think I did it more than once. But don't forget, I've only got till the end of the year before other things are going to be happening, or I'm going somewhere else, or we're going somewhere else. And one would get in take the staff car out. There'd be a driver. You wouldn't drive it yourself. You'd have a driver and arrange with those where you were going, which direction you were going, where you were going, to look out for you and expect you. And off you'd go. I can't remember how long it took us to get to Baghdad. That's one thing that annoys me. I don't remember where we stopped. We would stop on the night, but we just drove up the Tigris. Of course, earth roads, nothing like they've got out there now. We went to Babylon. I've got a famous picture of Babylon of a crane or some large bird sitting on top of one of the pillars. The Hanging Gardens have long gone. Kut. Not Kut, Earl of the Chaldees is just a lump of a pile of earth, and there is a picture of that of Mike Butler standing on top of it, I think. It's archaeological sites, but not obviously so. And up to Baghdad, and then back. We used to go up and down on the train. This is another adventure, because the train, there was a meter gauge railway in those days. It's standard gauge now, from Basra to Baghdad. And I remember going up with a subsequent CSO, not Colonel Martin. And we set off. You should go off, catch the train in the evening in Basra, and trundle through the night and arrive at Baghdad in the morning. And I always remember they had to stop halfway to let us get out from our overnight carriages to go into the dining car, and it was invariably mutton or that or goat. But we had dinner on the train, and it all most civilized living, you see. But one day, I think we were coming, it doesn't matter which way we're going really, we were coming back from Basra, from Baghdad to Basra. This is during 43. And, out of most chaos, they got the wrong sort of locusts on the line. Absolute chaos. There's a picture again of a stationary train, and I believe I took that at the time that we'd been going one way and the was a single track railway anyway, with passing places, and absolutely couldn't go anymore. They couldn't get enough adhesion to proceed. I think what happened, we just got in the train and went. The train just went back. But there had been a swarm of locusts that come across. So we're somewhere halfway between Basra and Baghdad, and so we went back, and the other train went back, and. We tried again another day.
So this is sort of this is the sort of jaunt you'd go on.
Yeah,
checking the lines. And
yeah, that's it. That's what we went out for, to check the lines. Yes. Yeah, we had a good time though.